The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. On today's episode, we'll look at neurological illness from both a scientific and a personal perspective. Later on in the episode, we'll speak to Susanna Cahalan about her experiences being diagnosed with a newly discovered autoimmune disease. She's the author of Brain on Fire, My Month of Madness. But let's start out with some background. I'm here with Dr. Robert Tarswell. Rob is a clinical assistant professor on the Faculty of Medicine at the University of British Columbia. He has a dual specialty in nuclear medicine and psychiatry. Welcome back, Rob.
Thanks for having me back again.
Now, what's the difference between a neurological disorder and a psychiatric condition?
I'm going to solve that debate in the next 60 seconds, am I?
Big question, then?
Fairly big question. From the most simplistic end, you could say, well, neurological disorders are the kinds of diseases that end up getting referred to neurologists, and psychiatric disorders are the ones that kind of end up getting referred to psychiatrists. But broadly speaking, I think the best differentiation that I heard was when I was a medical student working with a neurologist, and we saw a patient on the medical floor, and this was somebody who was suffering from multiple sclerosis, and she was having unusual emotional and behavioral phenomena. And so then the question arose, is her shift in behavior a function of her multiple sclerosis, or is there some kind of psychological or psychiatric factor going on? And I went in with the neurologist and we took a history and examined the patient. Everything was fine and we were out in the hallway and talking with the consultation psychiatric service, and the neurologist said, you know, look, guys, I'm a technician. From my point of view, all the wiring is fine. I can't tell you if the light show is any good.
Ah.
Boom, boom.
But some neurological illnesses do appear to be psychiatric conditions, correct?
Yes. I mean, what is far, 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 far more common that psychological problem will manifest somatically. So that's a much bigger issue in a sense, but possibly much more fascinating, albeit smaller issue, are those weird and rare neurological disorders that have specific behavioral manifestations. The most obvious would be something like, say, Alzheimer's disease, where your brain is beginning to undergo degeneration because of neurofibrillary tangles and amyloid plaques, and you start losing your memory. So we think of memory as a psychological phenomenon, but the systems that serve memory come under attack in Alzheimer's disease. So there's a sort of a concrete example of a psychiatric manifestation of a neurological disease. And of course, there are hundreds, thousands of others, but rare, rare, rare.
Well, what's the process by which a doctor would use, I guess, to diagnose these kinds of illnesses, whether it be psychiatric or neurological?
If it's, a clear neurological problem, which would be something like, oh, gee, my left arm is weak for some reason. You go off to the family doctor. The family doctor will take a history of when did this start? How quickly was the onset? Does anything make it worse? Does anything make it better? Do you have any chronic conditions? Then conducts a neurological exam. And so would test strength in the left arm versus the right arm. Coordination in the left arm versus the right arm, the ability to do gross motor skill, fine motor skill, test sensation, and then do a neurological examination of the complete patient to make sure that there aren't other thus far sort of problems that might be emerging but are not yet sufficiently severe to have come to the patient's attention. And then at that point, depending on what the thought is, the individual might get referred for examinations or for neurological consultation, or if it's thought to be a surgical problem, then maybe for a neurosurgical opinion.
What would happen after somebody was referred to a neurologist? What are the tests there?
Well, the neurologist is going to do a more detailed history because they're going to have a much deeper knowledge of symptomatic manifestations of neurological disease, which could essentially be thought of as pathological processes of the brain, spinal cord, or peripheral or sympathetic nervous system. And then they're going to conduct a much more detailed neurological examination. And depending on the neurologist, they may be able to do other tests either in the office or in association with a clinic. So, for instance, testing the ability of NERS to conduct signals, the speed of signal conduction, the strength of signal conduction, and then other sorts of tests like EEG or evoked potentials, which is, all right, let's put these flashing patterns in front of your eyes and in your ears, and let's test how quickly that travels through the brain using scalp electrodes to detect activation of certain bundles of neurons in the brain. And then maybe CT or MRI as appropriate.
You make that all sound very smooth. I assume that that is 100% guaranteed to give you a proper diagnosis.
Oh, boy. If all, of course, in the vast majority of cases, the saying in medicine is common things are common. The vast majority of the time, we're going to get to the diagnosis. But of course, there are very rare, uncommon, and difficult to detect pathological processes that have really unusual symptomatic presentations. The sort of thing you might see once a year, once a decade, or maybe once in the entire course of your clinical career.
Well, is it only the rarity that makes these kind of illnesses so difficult to diagnose?
Not generally. Rarity is a big factor. It might even be the biggest factor. But also, when you're talking about neurological disorders that have primarily psychological or psychiatric manifestations, generally, you might be the patient that comes into the office and you don't even notice anything. Maybe your family notices, Tom is just seems more vacant lately. Just more apathetic. And it's really subtle and it comes on even very slowly. So it's a long time before anybody even really notices what's going on. And the neurological exam itself might be completely normal because the office neurological exam has, of course, limitations as to what it can detect. And if you have problems, roughly speaking, that don't manifestly affect sensation, your cranial nerves, which are the nerves in your brain that control facial sensation and facial motor function, or motor power coordination, it's not going to get picked up. And that testing all of that stuff is going to find lots of lesions. But if there's a lesion sitting, say, way out in the frontal lobe where executive function lives, which is, in a sense, the sort of the seat of personality and character, it may not have any impact at all on motor function. The only manifestation might be, say, Tom, who's apathetic, or somebody who engages in spectacularly inappropriate behavior.
Right.
Example I can give you, there was an obstetrician in the U.S. who, at the completion of a particular procedure, was so impressed with his work that he took the scalpel blade and elegantly carved his initials in the abdomen.
Shut up.
Find his work. And only later was it discovered, oh my God, this guy has Hick's disease, which is a kind of frontal lobe dementia. And he had lost the internal regulator that says, no, that's not okay to do that.
Okay, well, while I get over the autograph, you mentioned earlier that, there's psychological and physical dimensions to this, but isn't that true for all kinds of illnesses?
Absolutely. I mean, you have to remember that it's not just a disease that comes into the office. It's a person who is suffering. And the way we react to suffering has a lot to do with our own personalities, which are, of course, shaped by the sum total of experiences as superimposed on whatever genetic kind of basic characterological features we're born with or temperament. So somebody might be tend towards stoicism when they're suffering. Somebody might tend toward hysteria when they're suffering. Most of us might fall in between. Some of us might obsess about all the possible grave consequences of that thing on my finger, whereas other of us might ignore it until it's the size of a baseball. So you've got to deal with the person suffering. You also have to deal with their fears, their worries, and the way they regulate their emotional reactions to suffering as well.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking to Dr. Rob Tarswell about neurological disorders that may appear to be psychiatric issues. So maybe you could give us some examples.
So one disease that's not so commonly seen anymore, because we now live in the antibiotic era, but this was an absolutely spectacular success for biological psychiatry, was known as dementia paralytica, or general paralysis of the insane. For a long time, it wasn't even really known that the disease syphilis had any kind of a connection with behavior. I mean, for a long time, it wasn't even known that syphilis had anything to do with a microorganism. A lot of medical knowledge really started to explode in the 19th century when physicians took things like microscopes and actually started examining tissue to see if there was microscopic evidence of disease processes under the inspiration of a German pathologist called Virchow, who essentially could be, if you had to name one person, who's the person most responsible for anchoring medicine as a scientific discipline, you would have to go with Virchow, because he was the first one who really came along and said, okay, you know, we really have to do better than tradition. We have to do better than the lingering remnants of humor theory. In other words, you know, bad humors, good humors.
Right.
If we accept the fact that the body is a product of nature and that disease is a result of natural processes, we need to look at cells, which is the body is composed of, and we need to look for traces of disease in the cell. So under this inspiration, the 19th century really flourished as a time of discovering the cellular or histological basis of disease. And this marked a radical shift, and it tended to, in some ways, spark a lot of optimism, which was later, unfortunately, or for a time, displaced. Because one question that came up was, well, what about psychiatric disorders? Are these the products of cellular disorders in the brain? And one thing that became clear when they began histopathologically examining the brains of individuals who had died with psychiatric disease. Now, bear in mind, that was a fairly radical act in the 19th century, because the mad or the insane were essentially regarded as little more than curiosities. It was even in the 18th century, you could literally spend the day, throw a few coins in a box, and go to some asylums and see the mad chained to walls. So we're really almost literally talking about human refuse. So why bother examining the brains of the insane dead? I mean, really, they should just be handed over to medical students as cadavers for dissection practice. That's really all that they're good for. Well, wouldn't you know it, they discovered, hey, this thing that seems to be related to syphilis, these spirochetes, we're finding them in brains. We're finding them in the spinal cord. And of course, there was no cure for syphilis. So it would tend to progress to severely advanced syphilis. And it would take years for these symptoms to become manifest. So after you get the initial syphilitic infection, yes, you get the painful lesions of the genitals, but eventually those heal up. And at the time, it was concluded, oh, good, your syphilis is all better now. Well, 10 to 15 years later, individuals who'd had syphilis, now over a time course where it's very hard to link it back, would gradually descend into a kind of an insane paralysis. Nietzsche had tertiary syphilis, or syphilis which had penetrated his central nervous system. And so the thought was, okay, what happens if we could find a way to kill these spirochetes? Now, it was known that spirochetes are very sensitive to temperature. And in the era before we had developed antibiotics, there was a very brave or crazy psychiatrist, Julius Wagner Haureg, rest his soul, and may he forgive me if I've said that wrong. He decided to take individuals who had dementia paralytica, who are just lying on beds and can't really say yes or no anyway, and infect them with malaria, because malaria causes a high fever. He started by doing this with soldiers. Well, wouldn't you know it, the malaria did induce high fever, killed the spirochetes, and soldiers would come back who had been in these paralytic states. Now, fast forward a few decades to the 1940s, and it was discovered that syphilis, the T. falciparum, Treponema falciparum, which is the the taxonomic name of the spirochete, was exquisitely and is exquisitely sensitive to penicillin. But this was a huge, huge news story 100 years ago that we've managed to cure a chronic, irreversible psychiatric disorder somatically. This led to an enormous effort being poured into searching for brain-based causes for psychiatric disorders. So, okay, well, what causes mania? What causes dementia praecox, which we now know as schizophrenia? And it's an effort that ground to a halt very rapidly when it became pretty clear, based on the neuroscience of the day, that there weren't any more home runs to be had. Schizophrenic brains look a lot like normal brains. Bipolar brains or manic depressive brains. Emil Kraepelin, who was the first great psychopathologist, who would take people with different categories of psychiatric disorders and study them for decades and decades and decades to see what happened, was also a great advocate for histopathological-based sources of disease. And ultimately, that became a very frustrating endeavor. So other than spirochetes, syphilis, tertiary syphilis, and dementia paralytica, there really weren't any other biological sudden convincing cures for psychiatric disorders.
Well, that is not promising, sir, because I literally have pages and pages of syndromes and disorders where the symptoms manifest as psychiatric, but they are not. I can honestly say any of these. Can we talk about just alien hand syndrome? Because it's terrifying.
Yes, alien hand syndrome. It's absolutely fascinating. It has a lot of different manifestations. It can be all the way to the point where, after certain kinds of strokes, you will show the patient her own arm and you will say, "Whose arm is that? I don't know, but it's not mine." The patient comes to disidentify with the arm. And in strange ways, the arm somehow has come to disidentify with the patient. So perhaps you want to eat supper and you pick up your fork. The alien limb, meaning the limb you have disidentified with no longer is control, might reach over, grab the fork, and put it back on the table. Or you might be trying to wash your face and the alien limb might try to push your arm away, or you're trying to dress and so forth. So this can be a profoundly disabling condition.
I do not doubt that. All of these. Another one that I was looking at was misidentification syndrome.
Yeah, yeah. That can go in a few different ways. There's the one that loved ones have been replaced with carefully trained doubles who mean you some kind of harm. That is commonly seen in some forms of dementia, and particularly more the subcortical type of dementias, where you might have a situation where a man no longer recognizes his wife. He'll say, "Yes, that looks like Doris. That's how Doris dresses. That's how Doris acts. Isn't that an amazingly convincing actor?" And if the dementing person becomes suspicious enough and paranoid enough and agitated enough, may attack or even in some circumstances kill the no longer recognized other individual. I think another name for that particular problem is Capgras delusion.
Well, and I assume that there, in addition to these, there are a ton of cases where even after testing, you just can't say whether an illness is neurological or psychiatric.
Yeah, that would be some of the more weird and rare inflammatory type or autoimmune type of conditions where, because ultimately, if you want to know whether an organ is diseased or not, ultimately, we go back to Virchow's method. You take a sample of tissue from it. Well, there's not a lot of people lining up to say, "Yes, please take a tissue sample from my brain and look at it under a microscope and apply all sorts of tests to it." So we try to infer as much as we can the condition of the brain from EEG, maybe from lumbar puncture, from CT scans, from MRI scans, and from blood work. These ultimately, as amazing as they are, and let's add functional tests such as PET scans or nuclear medicine SPECT scans to the mix, nothing ultimately replaces a pathologist actually having some tissue to look at. Well, if something is happening at a submicroscopic scale, we're not really going to be able to detect it with an MRI, which would have the maximum spatial resolution, gets down to about a millimeter. But there's all kinds of stuff happening underneath the 1 millimeter scale. When you think about it, you know, 1 cubic millimeter is going to contain hundreds of thousands of cells. From the cell's point of view, that's a large city. So it's sort of like trying to figure out what's happening in, pick an example, Abbotsford, British Columbia, using satellites in orbit. It's you can see Vancouver, right? And, oh, look, there's Vancouver. And there's some sort of vague little dot that, no, maybe that's Abbotsford. Oh, maybe that's Langley. I can't tell. And that's sort of what it is to use an MRI to try and find pathophysiologic processes occurring at a molecular scale.
Rob, thank you for helping to explain that. We always love you here. Thanks for coming. You can find a link to Dr. Rob Tarswell's video series, 1 Minute Medical School, on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. After the break, we'll be joined by Susanna Cahalan, author of the book Brain on Fire, about her experience with a rare autoimmune disease. Stay tuned.
Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and I'm joined by Susanna Cahalan, an award-winning reporter at the New York Post. Susanna's the author of a book about her own experiences contracting a rare autoimmune disease, Brain on Fire, My Month of Madness. Welcome to the show, Susanna.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, let's set the stage here. You're 24. You're a reporter for the New York Post. Everything's going well there. You're in a lovely new relationship. Things are brilliant. So when did you think that something might be wrong with you?
You know, it's interesting because at the time, I didn't really know what was going on, so I didn't really have a moment. But looking back, I can trace the kind of the time when things started to unravel a bit. And I trace that time back to the moment where I believed that I had bed bugs. You know, at the time in 2009 when this was happening, pretty much everyone had bed bugs. Everyone thought they had bed bugs. It was pretty much, you know, they were in park benches, they were in movie theaters, you know, everyone, it was kind of this fear. And I worked for a tabloid, so we wrote a lot about it. So it wasn't really surprising that I too thought that I had them. But what was surprising looking back is how obsessively I fixated on the idea that I had these bugs, even when I had an exterminator come in and check out my apartment and he said, you know, there's no evidence that they're actually there. But I insisted that he exterminate anyway, you know, and I thought about them. I dreamed about them. To me, that's the beginning of when things started going wrong, though then I didn't really realize that. I really thought I had those bugs.
And then things continued on sort of in that vein. You were showing a lot of behavioral changes, things that weren't typical for you.
Exactly. They weren't scary enough that I said, okay, I have to run to a psychiatrist or I have to go to a doctor. They were subtle. You know, I just started dating my boyfriend. We'd been dating for about 4 or 5 months. I became fixated again on the idea that he was cheating on me. And so I rifled through his things and knew through all of his possessions in search of this evidence that didn't exist. And I remember when I read about this moment in my book, catching sight of myself in the mirror, not recognizing that person and just thinking, this is so outside of my normal behavior. And I'd realized then that during my snooping and my search for this, you know, evidence of his philandering, I had actually lost 2 hours. Really, I almost had an out-of-body experience during that time.
How were the people around you responding to your behavior?
It wasn't so extreme. I mean, I remember telling my friends, you know, I did this thing where I, you know, snooped through my boyfriend's things. Should I be concerned? And isn't that very strange? And they're like, well, not really. It's not really that strange, you know? They basically said, you know, I think everyone's done that at some point. None of the behaviors were that extreme that I had to kind of run to a hospital yet. But I think as the disease progressed, I became worse and worse. And it was a time when I was unable to kind of do my job that the people around me started to become very concerned. So there was a point when I interviewed a famous TV show host here. I couldn't even concentrate on his words enough to write them down. And I remember remember just really bumbling this interview and talking to my editor that day and just being very manic. One moment I'm crying hysterically at my desk, and the next moment I'm laughing and I'm feeling so great and filled with excitement, and I wanted to do every story possible. I wanted to be the best journalist in the world. It seemed in a way so extreme at that point that everyone around me was very concerned.
At what point did you finally see a doctor?
I had gone to a doctor when I had numbness on the left side of my body early on in this. So around the time when I had that bed bug scare and when I started snooping, I realized that I had numbness on one side. And I actually didn't connect the physical with the emotional behaviors yet. At that point, I went to a neurologist. They did an MRI and it came back completely normal. They did blood work and that came back normal. The only thing that was a little bit off was I had slightly enlarged lymph nodes in my spine, which led them to believe that I was probably suffering from mono, which is, you know, the kissing disease. We call it a kissing disease here. It's a virus. People in their teens get it. So that's what they think, you know, you probably have mono. Just ride it out. And then I went back to the doctor after that day that I described about, you know, being very manic, crying at my desk and then laughing. And that night I actually had a seizure. That moment was between the sane person I was before and then the complete insanity that followed. So it's kind of that dark line that I draw. And after that, I actually don't really have many memories from the time. So I had to really, to recreate it, I had to rely on other people, on outside sources. But that was a really especially scary moment. And my boyfriend was with me at the time, and, you know, he called 911, and we ended up in the hospital. While we were there, the doctors just said, sometimes people have seizures, and they let us go. You know, just that night, they just let us go and said, you should probably see a neurologist in the morning.
How bad did it have to get for them to admit you?
The next week after I'd had that seizure, my mom collected me from my home in Manhattan, and I went back to the suburbs of New Jersey where I grew up. Kept having seizures. My behavior was getting worse and worse and worse. I mean, more frighteningly psychotic, fluctuating from one moment to the next. And the seizures continued. Some of the seizures were full body, which were grand mal seizures, very intense looking, the shaking, all of those characteristics of what you think of as a seizure. But then there's also other types of seizures called petite mal seizures, where you basically just kind of stare off into space. And I was having a lot of those too. So I kept going back to the same neurologist who initially said I had mono. We kept going back to him. He kept just saying, you know, you'll be fine. Just take these anti-seizure medications and you'll be fine. And then he insisted, when my mom was saying, this is not getting better, this is getting worse, and she's getting worse in so many different ways, he actually said that he believed that I was suffering from alcohol withdrawal, which was, yeah.
How much do you drink, or did you drink at that point?
So at the time, I told him that I drank 2 glasses of wine per night. And, you know, it ranged, you know, I was 24 years old. Some days I wouldn't drink, and then some days I'd drink a couple glasses of wine. It was fairly normal for that age. And then when I actually got my medical records later, he wrote down 2 bottles of wine per night, which is very different from 2 glasses of wine per night.
So, and now you said, from this point on, you were admitted to the hospital, mostly because your mother forced the issue. And from that point on, you really don't remember much. So why mm-hmm. was that?
The disease itself, it affects a certain part of the brain, certain parts of the brain, specifically the hippocampus, which is really, I mean, primarily important in memory formation, and especially long-term memory formation. Since that part of the brain was affected in this disease, I really didn't have the capacity to really make memory. It's frightening because, you know, I remember some things from that time. I remember hallucinations largely. I really struggled with that. I said, why do I remember things that weren't real? Whereas I don't remember reality. You know, I don't remember the things that actually happened. And I found out later that because hallucinations tend to be of a high emotional content, they're actually encoded in the brain in a stronger way, so that you're more likely to remember them. But so basically, all I really remember from that time are fictitious, paranoid thoughts that I had.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking to Susanna Cahalan, author of Brain on Fire, My Month of Madness. So how did you piece together what happened during that month in the hospital?
I started off basically with trying to get what I could remember, get at what I could remember, even the things that didn't make any sense. So I collected every single memory I possibly could untarnished by talking to other people. I tried to just get it as honest as I could and from my own mind. From there, I interviewed doctors, nurses, family, friends, everyone I possibly came in contact with, I interviewed. I also got my hands on medical records from the time, which were amazingly helpful because in a way they served as my kind of an objective fact. Like, you know, on April 2nd, I had this spinal tap. On April 3rd, I tried to escape. You know, I had all these kind of posts throughout my time. I could kind of chart my time through these medical records. And I also had videos from my time in the hospital because after continuing to have the seizures, the neurologist who believed I had alcohol or was suffering from alcohol withdrawal agreed to have me admitted to NYU Langone Medical Center's epilepsy ward, which is where they monitor you for seizures and seizure activity. And so they also have video correspondence. They actually film you as well as monitor your brain waves as well. So I have these bizarre videos of myself going crazy in the hospital. Those are the kind of ways I piece it together.
In effect, you're trying to report objectively on your own life.
Right.
How did that feel?
It's really impossible to be objective. I mean, it's impossible to be objective about anything, really. It's hard, you know? But then you're talking about yourself. It's impossible. I tried really hard, and I really, in a lot of ways, didn't feel like I was writing about myself in a good bulk of the book, especially in the part we're talking about right now, which is the month-long hospital stay. For me, when I hear about the things that I did and I read about the things that I did, I really feel as if I'm talking about someone else or hearing about someone else. There's a real disconnect there. So I think that made it easier for me to be objective.
Talk about some of those changes that you experienced in the hospital, because even though you can't remember, you do have that documented and you did get progressively mm-hmm. worse.
Mm-hmm. And I do remember some of my hallucinations from that time as well. So I was admitted to the hospital. And I was first placed in a 4-person room, which in retrospect, probably wasn't the best place for an actively psychotic person to be because hospitals are scary anyway. But when you put 3 other people in a room with you, I mean, it was just too much activity. And so when I was first there, I was in that AMU room for about 4 or 5 days. And during that time, I was the most acutely psychotic. I actually have video of myself, and I remember this hallucination, but I believe that I was on the news. The day before I was admitted to the hospital, I was with my mother for that week, but she, you know, I was so out of my mind, I mean, for lack of a better word, and I was suffering from such extreme insomnia, and she always thought that someone had to be monitoring me, that she was so tired by this, that she actually sent me to my father's house in Brooklyn Heights. And there, I had one of the worst and most vivid visual hallucinations and auditory hallucinations of the time where I actually heard my father beating my stepmother. Really saw it and heard it. I mean, it didn't happen, but I, you know, that's what I heard. And so when I was in the hospital, that hallucination stayed with me. It stayed with me. And I actually, at one point, saw myself on the news because my father, and this elaborate, hallucinatory kind of, you know, creation that my mind made, my father had killed my stepmother. And now all newspapers were camped outside the hospital waiting to interview me. And I actually believed that the nurses were trying to get information from me. And at one point believed that the nurses were actually my father turning into people to try to spy on me. And then I believe that the woman next, you know, in that 4-person room, I believe that the patient right to my left was actually a newspaper reporter spying on me as well. It's interesting that all these are media related. I think it's because of my history as a media person. But yeah, I really had these paranoid, very, you know, extremely persecuted, you know, I believe that I was being persecuted by everyone around me. That was one of them. But you know, they ranged. So I had this, you know, huge persecution complex in one side of the spectrum, but then another hallucination, I actually, and I remember this vividly, I believed that I could age people with my mind. And so I was looking at a doctor and I could see the wrinkles form. If I stared at her hard enough, the wrinkles would form in her face, her hair would turn gray. And then I'd turned and looked at my boyfriend, Steven, and I could do the same to him. And meanwhile, I could actually make the doctor younger. And I remember seeing this, and I remember feeling so powerful, you know, this kind of grandiose, which is apparently part of this disease. It can make you feel very, even hyper-religious in some senses too. But for me, this was this kind of grandiose sense of power. So those are kind of, this is what I was functioning with at that hospital. And at several points during my stay, I tried to escape and was actively violent towards the staff. Because again, you know, the nurses were undercover trying to, you know, monitor me, and they're turning into people. So I clearly wanted out of there. And so I tried really hard to escape, and I was kicking and punching nurses and biting them. And I mean, horrible behavior. You know, hearing it now.
But then you go from that to a little bit, and not very much farther on, you were almost catatonic.
As the disease progresses, basically you go from acutely psychotic, so they get kind of overexcited, and you get that kind of psychosis, right? And that almost this, like, you know, hypermanic state. And then as the disease takes its course, those parts of the brain become so overexcited that they actually fail to function. At that point, you have catatonia. And catatonia is really the absence of emotion and absence of behavior. So about a week or week and a half in, I started showing signs of catatonia. I stopped being able to read. I could hardly write. I really couldn't talk. I developed a substantial lisp. I had trouble swallowing. I couldn't really walk. At various points, I did these strange dystonic movements where I would actually leave my arms out at unnatural poses. For example, I would leave my arms out straight in front of me like I was a mummy. You know, it's that kind of zombie-like movements. Or I would keep my wrists at this 90-degree angle, these very uncomfortable angles that normally you wouldn't be able to hold because they're just so uncomfortable. But apparently the part of the brain affected by this disease that is aware of spatial, where your body is in space, is affected, so you don't even really realize, you know, doesn't even register that your hands are at these strange places. Yeah, so it went from psychosis to really acute catatonia. I mean, I was very catatonic.
I need people to understand this. The issue is during this entire time, no one had any idea what was going on with you. There was no diagnosis.
No. When I was first admitted, very commonly, you see psychosis after seizures, and it's a condition called post-ictal psychosis, and they were thinking maybe this is post-ictal psychosis, but I wasn't having any more seizures, and I was still psychotic, and I was getting catatonic, so it didn't make sense. Then there was other psychiatric conditions that were being bandied about. So one of the diagnoses that was offered is called schizoaffective disorder. It's basically a combination of schizophrenia and bipolar disorder features. So that was the prevailing diagnosis at that point, because all the tests were coming back clean. You know, on paper, yeah, I was a healthy person, but I was getting worse and worse and worse. Really, at one point, the head of my case actually called on another person, a man named Suhail Najjar, to take over because he was at a loss.
And there wasn't just one person working on your case at that point.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I would say over 10 doctors were working on this. I mean, it was a real group effort, you know, not for lack of trying. I mean, there were so many ideas and so many tests, but none of it made sense. You know, if I was getting worse and worse, it was, I imagine, very frightening for them.
This is Skeptically Speaking, and I've been talking to Susanna Cahalan, the author of Brain on Fire, My Month of Madness. And we'll be right back with more after these messages.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're looking at the science and the history of the water that makes life and society possible. We'll speak to law and environment professor James Salzman about his book Drinking Water, A History. And we're joined by Juan Liu, chemistry professor at the University of Waterloo, to talk about his work using DNA to detect waterborne impurities that could make water unsafe. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and my guest is Susanna Cahalan, author of Brain on Fire, a book about her experiences with a rare autoimmune disease. So before the break, you mentioned Dr. Najjar. Tell us about him.
Well, you know, he is such an interesting man and character, really. I mean, he's originally from Syria, and I think because of his personal history, he is such an excellent doctor. So when he was a child, when he was about 10 years old, he was kicked out of private Catholic school, because he was, quote, too slow. And his teacher told his parents that he should learn a trade because he would never be successful in the academic world, which is incredible. But, you know, now hearing his story, he ended up going to public school, graduating top of his class, going to medical school in Syria, graduating top of his class there, and then he came to the United States, and he now is an epileptologist, a neurologist, epileptologist. He also is a researcher, you know, obviously a clinician. I mean, he's amazing, incredibly talented, and now considered one of the best doctors in the country. So at that time, he had been doing research, tentative research on autoimmune diseases in general, and he had actually made quite a name for himself and actually was on a television program of some sort, you know, some kind of medical mystery program, because he encountered a kid who was having nonstop seizures, and, you know, I mean, up to 100 seizures a day. And this child was actually, you know, he was seen by eminent epileptologist who believe that they should resect take out parts of his brain. And so they did this resection surgery, and the seizures continued. The seizure focus moved, and he began seizing in kind of the frontal lobe area, which is a very dangerous area. And so they said, you know what, we need to do another resection surgery. We need to do a second one. And that's when Dr. Najjar was called on, and he said, you know what, hold up. We can't do the surgery again. This is very dangerous. I really think this is some kind of an autoimmune reaction in the brain. Let me study his brain. Let me take a piece of the brain that you guys resected and take a look at it under a microscope. And at that point, he found evidence of inflammation in the brain, and he treated the child, not with surgery, but with you know, immune suppressants like steroids and IVIG treatment and plasmapheresis. And the child got 90% of the seizures went away, and he's actually doing very well and functioning very highly at this point. So that's the kind of context that Dr. Najjar enters my life. So this other doctor approaches Dr. Najjar when, you know, I'm getting worse and they're not, the evidence is just not there. They can't figure out what's wrong with me. And so he comes in, and kind of with this history, he sits down with me and my family, and he, you know, comes in, he takes an extremely detailed health history. You know, I know this because I have the medical record, so it's all handwritten, and I think it was about 4 pages of health history, which typically in my other experiences, there were types of pages that were about, you know, a third of a page. So this is someone who was, you know, getting very detailed, and he had everything in there. He had the numbness, which was very much overlooked at this point. He had, I think he even had the mention to the bed bugs in there. I had high blood pressure that was in there. Then there was the psychosis. Then there was, you know, a very beautiful painting emerged, you know, portrait of my dysfunction emerged. And at that point, he came up with the idea to ask me to draw a clock. And the clock test is typically given to stroke and Alzheimer's patients to kind of get an idea of kind of how their brain is functioning. And it's not typically given to a 24-year-old. So it was, you know, so he sat down and he handed me a piece of paper and he said, you know, draw a clock and put in the numbers 1 through 12. And I did, and I put all of the numbers on the right-hand side of the clock. I smushed them all in as if the left-hand side did not exist. It was almost a perfect specimen where the 12 o'clock landed right where the 6 o'clock should have been. And so at that point, he, you know, nearly applauded. I mean, he was so excited to see this. I don't remember any of this. This is all recounted to me. He actually, you know, got up out of his seat and showed my parents his paper. And he explained to them, you know, in ways, you know, he's so smart and he has a hard time kind of dumbing it down. So I think they were kind of following him, like, what is going on here? But he basically, what he was trying to say is that the right side of my brain seemed to be malfunctioning because the right side is responsible for the left field of vision. And at that point, he thought, okay, is this another type of inflammation caused by an autoimmune process? Is it possible it's at all similar to this boy who I saw years before? And so, the only way to prove that I had inflammation there, he felt, was to do a brain biopsy. So he actually took my parents out of the hospital room and said, her brain is on fire. And he used those words, her brain is on fire. And he said, I think the next step for us is to do a brain biopsy. And, you know, my father's mother was a nurse, and she had absolutely no faith in brain surgeons or anyone who dealt with the brain. I mean, she really did not had a distaste for them. And so my father was very concerned. Obviously, my mother was extremely concerned. I mean, it's just scary. But they really believed in him almost immediately. I mean, he had this sensibility that you just felt connected to him, like a member of the family when he walked in that room. And so they agreed. So at that point, the brain biopsy was scheduled for, I think, 2 days later. And he studied the sample of my brain, and he discovered inflammation there. And so he immediately put me on a round of steroids, of IV steroids. And at that point, you know, it's almost as if, like a child's flip book, you know, all the papers he had read about autoimmune diseases, because he had a vested interest in this, he remembered a study that had come out in 2007. Now, this was 2009 now. So 2007, a study had come out from the University of Pennsylvania by a doctor named Joseph Dalmau. And the whole study was that he had found that these women had come in all presenting with a psychiatric components and seizures. And what he found was that it was this autoimmune process that was happening, where the immune system actually somehow, they don't really quite know what triggered it. In some cases, it's a teratoma in the ovaries, which is kind of, you know, an ovarian cyst in the ovaries. In other cases, the cause is unknown. But basically, for some reason, the immune system is kind of ratcheted up, and it gets overexcited and makes these certain antibodies that target certain receptors in the brain called the NMDA receptors. And so with this in mind, Dr. Najjar had me have another spinal tap of many spinal taps that I had before, and he sent my spinal fluid over to the University of Pennsylvania, at that point the only place in the world to test for this disease. And because of this clock test, and because of, you know, just because he read the literature, I was diagnosed with what's called anti-NMDA receptor autoimmune encephalitis, which basically, you know, it had been only around for 2 years previously, and I was the 217th person to be diagnosed with the disease.
And so, you know, that's obviously you were desperately looking for a diagnosis, which is great. But what were you told about the survival rate with this illness?
You know, again, you know, that time it was still so up in the air, but it was a celebration in a lot of ways, because there is a high rate of survival. And so, you know, now it's even greater known that I think it's about 80% have a good prognosis. Then I don't think they had those numbers, but now it's known that about 80% have, I know good is relative, but it's still good. And so at that point, Dr. Najjar, after we got our diagnosis, I think it was the 16th of April, after being in the hospital for a month, I left the hospital 2 days later, and he said to my parents, I believe that she could get 90% of her cognitive ability back. Now, looking at now, I think, oh, that's so depressing, thinking about 10% less of yourself. I mean, it's not everything, you know, I mean, 10% of yourself, that's who you are. But my parents were thrilled. I mean, absolutely thrilled, because at that time, my cognitive tests were all pretty much severely disabled. I mean, I could hardly do anything. I mean, all my basic cognitive abilities were shot. And so the idea that 90% was really, really a hopeful and wonderful thing to hear. So in a large way, it was a cause for celebration.
You're tuned in to Skeptically Speaking. I've been talking with Susanna Cahalan, reporter at the New York Post and the author of Brain on Fire, My Month of Madness. So what was the recovery process like? Because it took a long time.
Yes, you know, and actually, compared to other people, it was quite fast. But it did take a long time. And so, you know, so I was treated with immune suppressants, steroids, IVIG treatment, and plasmapheresis, and a lot of it for a long period of time, for about a year. And so, you know, when I was first released from the hospital, I couldn't read and I couldn't write. And so that's how far I had to come. I mean, there was talks of having to have a 24-hour nurse. And, you know, I improved fairly rapidly in the beginning. You know, I remember about a month or a month and a half after that, I could actually, maybe 2 months after I was released, I could actually write in a journal again. And I actually have that journal. But after that kind of swift recovery, in terms of that basic recovery, the more subtle parts of the personality, you know, just confidence and the ability to make small talk and all, ordering a Starbucks was hard for me, you know, ordering a coffee, you know, just seeing old friends, all these things were so difficult for so long. So I returned to work about 7 months after my diagnosis, and I wasn't myself then. And my employer at the Post, they were really wonderful to me, and they were really patient and understanding, and they would throw me really easy stories like hottest bartender in New York City, which, you know, a four-year-old could probably write. So they really kind of, and I didn't really notice. They didn't make me painfully aware of it, but everyone around me was painfully aware. You know, the rumor around the Post was that they had given me the job back because I felt sorry for them, or I would sue them if they didn't. So, I mean, I was obviously very physically, I was still very far from myself, and I had gained about 40 pounds, so I didn't look like myself, and I had steroid face, so I was all moon-shaped. It was extremely painful, and I think that it probably took about a year for me to feel comfortable in my own skin again. So that's a long time to kind of feel out of body, you know. But the average, you know, recovery rate takes about 14 months. So I was actually very lucky compared to other people. Not everyone recovers fully.
Well, honestly, the way that you wrote about your recovery period was heart-wrenching. Absolutely. Aww. And I think that's, you know, the rest of this seems like a medical mystery novel, but we don't hear enough about sort of what happens after the cameras stop rolling. So I very much appreciate that.
Oh, that makes me feel really good because, you know, it's interesting because in terms of reactions to the book, people who've gone through anything like this really appreciated the recovery part. But I think that some people found it very slow. I think that's what I've heard. But
well,
for me,
no
the third part
is in that part.
Right, there's no like exciting. Yeah, it's very, you know, in a lot of ways the mystery is solved. So like the kind of catalyst, the narrative is over. But for me, the third part of the book, this recovery part, and the idea of memory and the idea of identity and self, it's the most important part of the book. So for me, it's my favorite part of the book. It might not be everyone's favorite part, but it's my favorite part. So
well, but you know, the story is not over, I would say, because
right.
You still don't know how you contracted this in the first place. Nobody
exactly.
does.
Exactly. No, I mean, that's just the thing. I mean, there's still so many mysteries that surround this disease, and that's a major one. And basically, like I said before, it's, you know, in about 50% of cases, there's an ovarian teratoma, and the idea is that, you know, there's actually brain matter in that cyst in the ovaries, and the body gets confused attacking that brain matter and starts to attack its own brain. But I didn't have an ovarian teratoma, so what caused my body to attack itself? You know, no one knows, and it's a huge question, and a subject of a lot of research now. What actually causes this disease?
So now you were asked by the Post to write an article on your experiences, and it went out in critical acclaim. But people started contacting you about this, their own experiences. And it was interesting because when I was reading the book, at a certain point, I was thinking, I wonder if she has survival guilt. And then I neared the end of the book and you have an entire chapter titled Survivor Guilt. So how are you? So yes, is the answer. How are you dealing with that now?
You know, it's even tenfold more now than it was when I wrote that the initial article in 2009. It's amazing. I mean, it's in a way, you know, the guilt is so much less. The incredible, I don't even know what the word, I mean, just the incredible responses I've gotten make any guilt or any feeling like that, it almost in a way nullifies them, because I know that through telling my story, I can honestly say I've saved people's lives. I helped save people's lives by sharing my story. People have gotten diagnoses because they read my book or heard about my book or heard an interview. So in a way, it doesn't, you know, though I do have these questions of, why did I recover so well when other people didn't? I meet people all the time. I do readings across the country and in Canada, and I've met many people who have survived this disease, and a lot of those people are not doing as well, or some of those people are not doing as well as I have done. And it is really, you know, it's really emotional whenever I run into these people. And I know it's not a resentment at all that they feel. Instead, it's kind of the opposite. I think in a way I give them a hope that they too can have this return. So that makes me feel very good too. But it is difficult sometimes questioning, you know, why I had such an amazing return. And I'm so thankful for it, obviously. But
that's the thing. You know, we're just beginning to understand how our brains work. And it's such a new field. And you were, you know, I hate to say it, but you were pretty much in the right place at the right time for that for that diagnosis and treatment. But you do recognize that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, luck. I mean, it's basically, I was so lucky. It's just, that's like really the only word, because there are, I've talked to other people, and I've talked to, you know, parents who are doctors themselves in very connected universities who have taken 9 months to years to get their children properly diagnosed with this disease. I didn't have a doctor as a parent. You know, I didn't have a connection to a university. But somehow I was able to reach Dr. Najjar, who not only knew enough to think about this disease, but knew how to aggressively treat it. I mean, that's a big thing with this disease, is swift and aggressive treatment. So he didn't wait to get my diagnosis before treating me. He immediately, when he got that brain biopsy, put me on huge amounts of steroids. Now, other doctors might have been like, oh, maybe we should wait. You know, we don't know. We don't want to jump the gun here. We want to be a little bit tentative. He wasn't tentative at all. And I think that's a big reason why I'm back as quickly as I was and as fully.
So has this actually caused sort of a spike in research into this disease then?
I think it will. I think we're right on the cusp of this. I'm actually involved with an incredible organization, and it's a very young one. It actually was kind of just incorporated. It's members of the Duke University here in North Carolina, and a family of a daughter who actually lost her battle to autoimmune encephalitis at 6 years old. But her parents are so amazing that instead of kind of crawling under a rock and just like, and which I couldn't blame anyone for doing, they've actually, it's galvanized them to want to get answers. And so they've put, you know, I'm involved with them, and they've put together this Autoimmune Encephalitis Alliance, and they're actually bringing in NYU, Dr. Najjar and NYU, hopefully members of Yale and members of Stanford, to kind of come together to put together kind of a place of thought and learning and treatment and diagnosis and research of this disease in a way that's kind of never been done before. So I think that interest is definitely up, and I think that there's a lot of research out there, but I think it's only the beginning. I think there's going to be more and more, because this disease is not only interesting in and of itself. Of course, it's a kind of fascinating disease, but it also raises questions about how the brain works and how the brain works when it malfunctions, and how, you know, psychiatric conditions arise as well. I mean, you know, studying this disease gets us closer to understanding what happens to the brain when someone has schizophrenia.
Well, congratulations on everything. And it was a tremendous, absolutely tremendous read. Thanks very much for coming.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
You can find Susanna Cahalan and her book, Brain on Fire, at the link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, you are highly encouraged to click the links to Twitter, Facebook, and Google+, so that you can keep up with show news, and to iTunes, where you can download past episodes, subscribe to the show, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced and distributed by Suburban Panic Media. Our theme song was written and recorded by AOK. Our guest coordinator is Rochelle Saunders. Our social media manager is Chelsea Butler. Helen Quivillion is our production assistant. Ryan Bromsgrove is our production manager and assistant editor. Josh Witten is our researcher. The show is edited by K.O. Myers. And I'm your host, Desiree Schell.